The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive, everyone. We're here to, you know, shortcut your way to being well-informed. And today, we are immersing ourselves in a really foundational text, hugely powerful, I think, and universally relevant, the Dhammapada. It's a collection of wisdom attributed to the Buddha, and honestly, the promise it holds is just enormous.
Oh, it's incredibly exciting to tackle this one.
Yeah.
Because it's not just like abstract philosophy you read about. You know, lots of ancient texts offer spiritual insights, but the Dhammapada, it feels different. It's like a systematic, step-by-step guide to liberation, a pathway you can actually walk.
Right, not just a concept. And its relevance today is just immediate, isn't it? The book tackles what the source is called dukkha. Now, that word often gets translated as suffering, but it's maybe more than that. It seems to capture that modern feeling of, well, dissatisfaction, anxiety, that sense that something's just missing, even when things look good on the surface, that kind of constant, not quite right feeling.
Exactly. And the book really challenges this modern idea that if we just get the right job or the perfect relationship or, you know, the bigger house,
then we'll find lasting happiness.
Yeah.
Yeah. It pushes back hard against that. Mm-hmm. It insists right from the start that real lasting peace, it only comes through a profound inner transformation, not from changing your external circumstances.
So the message is, fix your life. You start with your mind. That's the radical shift it forces on you, really.
Okay, so let's talk about the person behind this revolutionary path. Siddhartha Gautama, born around, what, 563 BCE?
Mm-hmm.
Into royalty, extreme luxury, in present-day Nepal, a prince, totally shielded from hardship.
Yeah, groomed for comfort and power. But that bubble burst, didn't it, dramatically? The sources talk about this pivotal shift when he was about 29. He encountered the four sights, aging, sickness, death, and then, interestingly, a contented renunciant, someone who'd given it all up.
And seeing that, the fundamental impermanence and, frankly, the pain underlying everything.
Right.
It hit him hard. So hard, he just renounced his entire royal life, walked away to find an answer.
Wow. And he didn't just, like, sit under a tree immediately.
No, not at all. He spent 6 years on this intense spiritual quest. Tried everything from deep concentration practices to, well, really severe painful asceticism, punishing the body.
Until finally, age 35, under the Bodhi tree, enlightenment, he became the awakened one, the Buddha.
And what's really fascinating about this origin story is where his authority comes from. If he's the awakened one, his knowledge isn't from books or study or even like divine revelation from a god. It's grounded entirely in his own direct personal experiential realization.
That's a key difference. It's not faith-based in the usual sense.
Exactly. He's positioned more like a spiritual scientist or maybe a physician. He observed the human condition, diagnosed the root cause of suffering, and then rigorously tested a cure. A practical, repeatable cure.
And the proof is in the practice. Anyone can run the experiment themselves, essentially.
Right. And that approach is so central. It's also important, I think, to remember the Dhammapada itself isn't a book he sat down and wrote.
Good point. It's more a compilation, right?
A beautiful compilation, yeah. Of his most powerful sayings, these poetic verses. Preserved orally at first by his disciples, then later written down in the Pali Canon.
So we're benefiting from centuries of tested wisdom, carefully preserved.
That's nice. So if we boil the Dhammapada down, like to its absolute core, one sentence.
Go on.
The human mind is the ultimate source of all our suffering and crucially, all our happiness too.
That's incredibly powerful. And it makes the book's goal crystal clear. Liberation comes through purifying the mind.
Yeah.
Rigorously.
Right. Systematically weeding out what Buddhism calls the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. It's essentially a roadmap out of that constant anxiety and dissatisfaction we talked about.
And what I love is how comprehensive it is. It wasn't just for monks off in caves.
No, definitely not. The verses were originally spoken to everyone, kings managing kingdoms, merchants running businesses, ordinary householders dealing with family life.
So it's like a practical psychological manual for living skillfully designed for, well, pretty much everyone.
Exactly.
But if it's for busy people, people with jobs and responsibilities, what actual tools does it give them? How do you practice liberation while, you know, dealing with emails and deadlines?
Well, the structure itself kind of guides you. The journey it lays out is very systematic. It starts with understanding the primacy of the mind, taking personal responsibility. Then it moves into practical ethics. That's where karma comes in. Then a really intense focus on mental discipline, mindfulness. And finally, it culminates in wisdom and the ultimate goal, nirvana.
So it covers both everyday ethics and the big ultimate questions.
Mm-hmm. That's what really distinguishes it, I think. That radical practicality over just abstract ideas gives you actionable principles for managing anger, improving relationships, work ethics.
While also aiming for that transcendent goal of ending suffering completely.
Spot on. Okay, shall we dive into some of the deep cuts?
Yeah.
The key chapters that show how this roadmap unfolds?
Let's do it. Starting with the foundation of the mind, chapters 1, 2, 3.
Right. Chapter 1, the famous twin verses. It hammers home that law of cause and effect, karma, immediately. Uses these really vivid analogies. Suffering follows harmful actions like a wheel follows the ox. Just relentlessly crushing you.
Oof. Yeah, that's stark. But there's the flip side, right?
Absolutely. Happiness follows skillful actions like an inseparable shadow. The point is inescapable. Your mental states, your intentions, they're the engine driving your destiny. You're not just a victim of circumstance.
You're the architect. Powerful.
And then chapter 2 introduces the way forward. Heedfulness. Appomatta, which is basically mindfulness, awareness.
And there's a real sense of urgency there, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. Heedfulness is the path to the deathless, to nirvana. Heedlessness, just being distracted, unaware, is the path to spiritual death.
Which sounds dramatic, but maybe think of heedlessness as just modern distraction. Endlessly scrolling, procrastinating, sleepwalking through life.
That's a perfect way to put it. The text says being fully present, fully aware, is the only way to stop creating future suffering. It's your only real security.
And chapter 3, the mind, explains why that awareness is so damn hard.
Mm-hmm. It calls the mind fickle, difficult to guard, compares it to a fish flapping around out of water, desperate for sensual gratification, for the next hit of pleasure.
Constantly restless. And taming that unruly mind is explicitly called the key to happiness. That sounds like maybe the hardest thing a person can possibly try to do.
It probably is. Okay, so moving from that inner struggle to how it plays out. Chapters 5 and 6 present these archetypes. The fool versus the wise person.
And the fool is interesting. They aren't necessarily like lacking intelligence.
No, it's moral ignorance. They know what's wholesome, what leads to well-being, but they just don't do it. They choose short-term pleasure, keep putting off the real work on themselves.
Sounds depressingly familiar, like anyone doom-scrolling instead of doing something meaningful.
Exactly. And the wise person is the total opposite. Practices self-control, listens to good advice, stays steady, doesn't get puffed up by praise or crushed by criticism.
Insistent, because their eye is on the long game liberation, not just the next dopamine hit.
Right. And then chapter 7 gives us the ideal model, the arahant, the worthy one, the fully enlightened being, free from suffering, free from rebirth. It sets the bar, shows what's possible with real dedication.
But even with these high ideals, the text keeps pulling you back to the present moment, doesn't it? Like in the ethics chapters, chapter 10 on violence.
Yes, that universal plea for ahimsa, nonviolence.
And it grounds it in such radical empathy. It basically says, look, everyone fears pain and death, just like you do, so don't inflict it. That feels foundational beyond any specific culture or time.
Truly timeless. And then chapter 11 hits you with Anicca, impermanence. It's quite poetic, but stark. Describes the body as a city of bones, where old age and death are just waiting.
Not to be morbid, though, the point is urgency, right? Don't wait. Prioritize your inner development now, because this life is temporary.
Exactly. Which leads us right to the root cause of all the trouble. Chapter 24, craving. Kana.
Ah, yes, craving.
This is the engine driving that whole cycle of dissatisfaction. It's described brilliantly as a creeping vine that just wraps around us, binds us to sorrow.
And that vine shows up every day, doesn't it? The need for validation, the itch for the next purchase, the hunger for approval.
All of it. The teaching is blunt.
Yeah.
You have to cut that root of craving. And the tool,
yeah,
the acts of wisdom, if you ever want to be free.
And speaking of wisdom, the final chapter, 26 on the Brahman, that offers one of the most radical social messages, doesn't it?
Huge. Because historically, in ancient India, Brahman was a title you got by birth, by caste,
yeah,
top of the hierarchy.
But the Buddha just flips that completely. He basically democratizes spiritual nobility.
Totally. He says a true Brahman, a truly noble person, isn't defined by birth or status at all. It's about inner purity, wisdom, letting go of all attachments.
Which means the highest attainment is potentially accessible to anyone. Anyone willing to do the work, regardless of who their parents were or what society thinks of them. That's revolutionary.
Absolutely. So, okay, let's zoom out. This amazing 2,500-year-old teaching, what does it really mean for us right here, right now? What are the core takeaways?
Okay, three big ones jump out. First, the primacy of mind. The idea that your mind is the architect of your reality.
Yeah, that line, the mind is the forerunner of all states.
Mm-hmm.
It's just incredibly empowering, isn't it? It shifts the locus of control entirely inward. If suffering is mind-made, then, well, liberation must be mind-made too.
Stop blaming the traffic. Start looking at your reaction to the traffic.
Exactly. Stop blaming external stuff. Look inside where the real power lies.
Second theme, the law of karma and personal responsibility. This isn't about fate or destiny being sealed.
No, it's a natural law, like gravity. Cause and effect. Yep. Wholesome intentions, skillful actions, they lead to beneficial results. Unwholesome ones create suffering. Simple as that.
Like the text says, you are your own master. You make your own future.
Which puts radical accountability on you, right? For the quality of your life. If you plant the seeds, you're responsible for the harvest. But that also means you have the power to change the seeds you're planting. No need to wait for an external savior or just hope for good luck.
And the third big one, impermanence and non-attachment, Anika.
Mm-hmm. All that grief we feel when things change or end, relationships, jobs, youth, possessions, it comes directly from clinging to things that were never going to last anyway.
The reflection here is just so practical for daily life. If you learn to hold things lightly,
you can actually engage with them more fully, appreciate them now, without being completely shattered when they inevitably change or disappear. It's a crucial skill for resilience, for managing disappointment and loss.
Absolutely. And the beauty of the Dhammapada is how these deep ideas are captured in such memorable, almost poetic lines. They really stick with you.
It's a total treasury of wisdom, isn't it? Let's share a few. That classic opening statement, all that we are is the result of what we have thought. The mind is everything, what we think we become.
Boom. That's a definitive statement on cognitive responsibility right there. Change your thinking. You literally change your being, change your world. Starts and ends with your thoughts.
And how about this one, the solution to conflict? Hatred does not cease by hatred, but only by love. This is the eternal rule.
Timeless. And let's be honest, incredibly difficult in practice, but profound. It says peace is an internal choice, an act of transformation through kindness, not just reacting to what others do.
Yeah. And one more. Redefining heroism.
Mm-hmm.
He who has conquered himself is a greater warrior than he who has conquered 1,000 men in 1,000 battles.
I love that one. Internal victory, mastering your own anger, your greed, your fear. That's a superior victory. Conquering the world is temporary. Conquering yourself is absolute. That's real strength.
So powerful. Okay, bringing it right down to earth. How do we apply this ancient wisdom, like today?
Well, the teachings on the mind are basically a framework for emotional regulation. It's almost like ancient cognitive behavioral therapy, you know?
Right. Use that mindfulness, that appomatta, to just observe difficult thoughts when they arise. Mm-hmm. See them clearly.
Yeah. Gain some space from anxiety or anger spirals. Recognize that thoughts are just thoughts. They aren't reality. They aren't commands you have to obey.
Mm-hmm. And karma. Use it as an ethical compass, especially at work or in leadership roles.
Mm-hmm.
Before a big decision, especially one impacting others, just pause and ask, okay, what's the real intention behind this? Is it rooted in clarity, in kindness, or is it coming from greed, fear, confusion?
That encourages long-term integrity, sustainable success, rather than just short-term gains.
And the third practical application, building resilience through understanding impermanence, Anika.
Oh, this is huge. Facing setbacks, failures. If you can internalize that this too shall pass, that everything changes.
You don't get completely shattered by failure. You stop wasting energy trying to control the uncontrollable external world and focus on mastering your internal response.
Mm.
That's where your power lies.
For me, the most valuable thing from this deep dive, it's that paradigm shift about where happiness actually comes from.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like genuine liberation from, you know, the endless cycle of consumerism. The idea that true lasting contentment comes from cultivating your mind, not from getting more stuff or achieving more status. It says you already have the equipment you need.
That's beautifully put. And for me, the final surprise, or maybe the most empowering lesson, is just that sheer sense of personal agency. The Dhammapada makes what seems like lofty spiritual development feel, well, accessible. Through discipline, through ethics, through paying attention.
Yeah, it really hammers home that we have so much more control over our own well-being, our own happiness than we usually think. In this text, it's like a practical roadmap to actually achieving that. Mm. Genuine human flourishing.
It really is. A magnificent guide for anyone just wanting a more peaceful mind in this chaotic world.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.